supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Emily is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today. Proposed changes to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, are now up online, and some have sparked a heated debate. The DSM was first published in the 1950s, and it has become increasingly important since then. On today's show, we'll hear about how the DSM is used, why it's so important, and how it is shaping research and policy. Later on in the show, we'll discuss one specific diagnosis up for review in the DSM-5, and that is childhood bipolar disorder. First, we're joined by Dr. Daryl Regier. He is the Executive Director of the American Psychiatric Institute for Research and Education and the Director of the Division of Research at the American Psychiatric Association. He is Vice Chair of the DSM-5 Task Force. Dr. Regier, welcome to Voices in the Family.
Thank you very much.
And it seems like we have a little bit of a disturbance in our line, so we'll try to optimize that. But let me start with the first question. I just mentioned the DSM was first published in the 1950s. What was the primary purpose then, and what was the need for the manual?
Well, the manual is used by clinicians and researchers to diagnose and classify mental disorders. And this really began far earlier, in an earlier version of diagnostic classifications, actually in the mid-1800s, when psychiatrists were responsible for mental health institutions. And there needed to be a way of identifying the different types of patients that were coming into these hospitals. This evolved over really decades and centuries until about 1950, when the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders was developed in the U.S. by the American Psychiatric Association. And since that DSM, there's been a revision in 1968, the DSM-2, 1980, which was a major change in the classification in 1980, and then in 1994 was the DSM-4. So we have been reviewing the research that's taken place since 1994 to really update the manual to reflect the current understanding of mental disorders.
Talk a little bit about how the DSM is used today by professionals in terms of diagnosis, but then also talk about the role it plays in insurance reimbursement, in framing policy, and so on.
The DSM is used not only by clinicians to communicate with each other about the nature of disorders that they are seeing, but also it's used by research investigators to submit grant applications to the National Institutes of Health in order to further study an understanding of both the causes of mental disorders and also to better understand treatments. The FDA uses the manual in order to provide a basis for indications for pharmacological treatments. And likewise, the organizations like the American Psychiatric Association then kind of aggregate information on specific treatments that are appropriate for individual diagnoses to develop practice guidelines for clinicians. So it's really an integral part of the healthcare system for insurance providers. They need to know what the diagnosis is that a clinician is submitting a claim for, and certainly for all these other research and clinical purposes.
Can you give us an example? You know, many of us have probably never seen a manual or used a manual, many of our listeners. So give an example of what a diagnosis looks like. What are the criteria? What kind of things are in there when we're looking, let's say, at depression?
Well, with depression, there are several types of depression, but the most common is major depressive disorder that has a total of 9 symptoms that tend to make up this disorder. And one can be diagnosed with a major depressive disorder if the symptoms, of at least 5 of the 9 symptoms, are present for more than 2 weeks. And they include things like a severe depressed mood, loss of interest in all things that previously interested somebody. There are sleep disturbances, appetite disturbances, cognitive problems in concentrating, and oftentimes this involuntary suicidal thinking that comes up spontaneously, unwanted, but it just intrudes itself into an individual's mind. And if one has sufficient duration of these symptoms, they interfere with a person's ability to function in their job and home and social relationships, they can meet criteria for a mental disorder of major depression. Now, one of the concerns that we have, though, is that in the current diagnosis of major depression, there are no symptoms of anxiety that are identified, even though we've found over the past number of years that more than 50% of individuals who meet criteria for major depression will have a significant anxiety component. And what we've also found is that people who have a high level of anxiety in addition to this 5 or more symptoms of major depression, that they're much more likely not to respond to available treatments, either psychotherapies or antidepressant medications, and they tend to have a worse clinical course. They also tend to have higher risks for suicide. So what we've begun to do is realize that there are some symptoms that aren't really captured within the current definitions that are important modifiers of the clinical picture and important for treatment.
And I want to get to more of that in just a second, but let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Dr. Daryl Regeer. He is vice chair of the DSM-5 Task Force. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is undergoing revisions. If you want to join our conversation, maybe the DSM changes will be affecting you, your life, your work. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. And Dr. Regeer, before I was giving out the number, you were talking about, I guess, what we often call co-occurring diagnoses. And I suppose one of the changes that the DSM is proposing to make is to have a main diagnosis and then an underlying diagnosis, so patients don't get these laundry lists of diagnoses, which often they end up with right now.
One of the things that we're proposing is to add to the current kind of categorical diagnoses, meaning that if you have, for example, a major depression diagnosis where you have at least 5 of the symptoms for a sufficient duration and severity to indicate that there is some underlying process, kind of physiologic process taking place in the brain that is not normal, that this has really ceased being just normal sadness that everybody experiences, that this has crossed a certain threshold where it becomes clinically significant. However, what we don't have really in the DSM right now are very clear dimensional measures that look at the level of severity of a given disorder with a greater degree of reliability or consistency in when we report these. In addition, as I was mentioning, we often have rather strict boundaries between disorders, so that if you have an anxiety disorder, you don't have a depressive disorder, and the fact that you might have both of these is not really recognized unless you meet full criteria for both disorders. But what we have found is that it's really important to have some cross-cutting dimensions of mood, of anxiety, of sleep problems, of appetite problems, of drug abuse problems that may cut across the current boundaries that we have, that we need to capture for each clinician and for each patient, so that we have a more comprehensive picture of the individual rather than just piling diagnoses on top of each other. We would like to have really more of a nuanced picture of the range of symptoms and that an individual actually has.
So in summary, the categories will be less rigid and will allow for some basically crossing of categories?
That's exactly right. And in fact, by doing this, what we would hope is that over time, our categories will change as well. So that, for example, we may very well have a category eventually of anxious depression, for which currently the FDA provides no indications for any kind of medication treatments, and no clinical trials are done by companies who do who provide pharmaceuticals, or by clinicians who do psychotherapy research, because it's not an indication, it's not a separate disorder, and it doesn't work that you can just say any trial that's good for, let's say, generalized anxiety disorder or for major depression will necessarily describe this this new syndrome or category in the middle that actually takes from symptoms of anxiety, depression, and perhaps somatic symptoms, physical symptoms of whether the digestive or pain or other symptoms that actually may form a more coherent system or diagnostic entity as it really appears in nature.
Now, if you've highlighted, I think, one of the really big and important changes in the new DSM, talk a bit about what's changing in the area of autism. There's also going to be, or there's a proposed change in how that is going to be diagnosed, not as different disorders, but as autism spectrum disorders.
Yes, there are currently really three disorders that have overlapping criteria and which have caused some confusion in the community as well as in the clinical settings and research settings. And these include something called pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, the PDD-NOS, autism, and Asperger's disease. Now, what has happened is that the criteria have been somewhat indistinct that to separate these, and it turns out that some of the Asperger's have been have many of the characteristics of autism. They tend to have a somewhat higher function and fewer language difficulties than do people with PDD-NOS or the or autistic disorder. But as research investigators have looked at this range of disorders, they found that there really is no defining threshold that separates these. And so what's more important is to understand the range of symptoms that are in different domains, including a kind of fixated interest and repetitive behavior, the problems with social interaction and interpersonal communication that are another part of the autism syndrome. And there are also some symptoms such as sensory processing symptoms that are common in each of these, in which some people are unable to tolerate noises or other sensory input, and you'll see children with autism will often have to wear headphones in order to block out some sensory information that's coming in. So it's necessary to really understand the full spectrum of symptoms in these different areas, and to by quantifying them in more of a dimensional fashion, it's felt that better treatments will emerge that than are coming out at the present time, just focusing on the categorical disorder of pervasive developmental disorder, autism, or Asperger's disease.
So the main impact here will be research, and not, you know, sometimes you wonder, well, how does this affect my family if my child is on the spectrum? So is the biggest impact of this change research?
Well, actually, it turns out that the current diagnostic classification often has profound effects on families because there are many legal and educational policies in the community that say you cannot get a special education services unless you have autism. And people who have PDD-NOS or if they have Asperger's have been denied those services, even though they could benefit from them. And so there is a concern that the somewhat artificial separation of these disorders has really had very significant impact on families. And we've heard this from families as the criteria have been announced in the press, and as families have gone on to the DSM-5.org website, they've been giving us feedback about how this diagnosis has affected them personally, as well as feedback from research investigators who are trying to help us clarify what would be a better way of classifying these disorders.
Now, one issue that has grabbed a lot of headlines, especially lately, is the issue of sex addictions. And that's something that will not be included in DSM-5, or so it looks like now. Can you comment on that? What was the thinking behind that?
The area of addiction is one that has really evolved substantially in the last, period of time, decades, since the DSM-4 was established. At that time, and also in the international community, there was a serious problem about even using the term addiction in the classification. There was, as a result, substance use disorder was identified, and one could have either substance dependence or substance abuse. But the term addiction was not really in either the ICD, International Classification of Diseases, or the DSM. And so since that time, you know, the term addiction has taken on a different connotation substantively. It has become much more common for, you know, in the language of the country. I mean, we're even talking about addicted to oil and things like that in the country. And so there's been a problem, though, with using the terms drug dependence as opposed to addiction. And that problem has been that it has really hampered people in the pain medicine area, where they have been concerned about giving people opiates and other drugs to substantially reduce their pain for fear that the person would become addicted whenever anybody developed tolerance to these medications. So so there's been a concern that we make it clear that there's a clear difference between addictions and tolerance and the whole thing of the whole concept of dependence. Well, that's a little bit of a background. So what has happened, the current plan given the lessened stigma of the term addiction, is to have an overall category that would say addictions and related disorders. And under that, you would have substance use disorder that would be also on a spectrum that would eliminate the dependence and abuse criteria so that it would be on a single spectrum, just like we're talking about autistic spectrum. You would define the number of, there's something like 11 symptoms in there, and you could have six or more would get you into the addiction area. The other thing is that we would place gambling as a behavioral addiction in that, because there's been an enormous amount of research on addiction that has shown that much of the brain circuitry that occurs with cocaine addiction or heroin addiction is very similar to the kind of reward circuitry that's present in gambling. And so we're having an increasing understanding of the biological basis for addiction, and that, in fact, based on the memory of these reward circuitries, people can develop kind of compulsive addictive behavior that is independent of medications. Now, so far in the area of sexual drives, we have not seen the evidence base to warrant calling that an addiction. And another area is internet use. In some areas, particularly in China and in Korea and Japan, there's a tremendous interest and concern about the public health consequences of particularly young people giving up most of their life to devote time to internet games and the like, and they want us to pursue having a more rigorous research effort into this area. And likewise, in the area of sexual behavior, there has been an interest in whether or not this kind of compulsive behavior actually has the same reward circuitry at place, despite adverse consequences for the individual that is present with these other addictions.
Okay, let me jump in there, sorry, because we are running out of time. Sure. For this segment. And you mentioned brain circuitry, and that brings mm-hmm. me to an issue that has raised some criticism, where the DSM uses behaviors to define and diagnose mental illness, but some say that what we're learning about the biological causes of mental illness and the genetic causes should also be included in the DSM. So where are we with that work, and how do you comment on that?
Well, there's been an amazing advance in neuroscience over the past few decades, but we don't believe that the research based on biological markers, including some of the brain imaging information, is yet practical for use in a clinical setting. We know that in some areas, particularly in the dementias, in Alzheimer's disease and the like, that the research has advanced to the point where Medicare is actually supporting using brain scans as a possible research basis for evaluating the presence of Alzheimer's disease in living patients, and not having to have an autopsy to confirm the diagnosis after death. But in most of the areas, we've really reviewed very carefully, particularly in the fear circuitry, kind of stress-induced fear circuitry area. There's an enormous amount of research there that we thought was one of the most promising area. But our experts, and we've had a series over 5 years of NIH conferences looking at the evidence on this, they said it's not yet what we call sensitive and specific that it can be used as a diagnostic marker. But this is a very promising area, and we hope to eventually to have laboratory tests of this nature that would be able to really identify circuitry that is clearly pathological and is specific for individual disorders.
All right, and with that, we're going to have to end this portion of the show. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Daryl Regier is the Executive Director of the American Psychiatric Institute for Research and Education, and he is Vice Chair of the DSM-5 Task Force. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at how the DSM influences research and talk a bit more about the brain circuitry that we've been talking about so far. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today, and this is Voices in the Family.
Support for WHYY is provided by Abington Memorial Hospital, now offering a new program for men with elevated PSAs who may be at risk for prostate cancer. The Prostate Evaluation Program brings together a multidisciplinary team of physicians and specialists who review cases together, providing recommendations and action steps for each individual. For more information, 215-481-MALE or AMH.org. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet professor, writer, and former dominatrix, Melissa Phoebos.
People are actually surprised. I did another interview recently where the interviewer asked me where my favorite boutiques for shopping for equipment were, and actually Home Depot was one of my favorite outlets.
Her new memoir is Whip Smart. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today. We're talking about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and the changes that are proposed for the new edition due out in 2013. And joining us now to focus in on one specific diagnosis are Alyssa Bronstein and Dr. Dimitri Papalos. Alyssa Bronstein is director of the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation, and her family is affected by this disorder. Papalos is co-director of the Program in Behavioral Genetics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He is director of research for the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation and the author of The Bipolar Child. Thanks for being here to both of you.
Thank you very
much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay. And let's back up a little bit, Dr. Papalos. Before our break, we were just getting to the issue of including biological markers and genetic markers into the DSM. Let's talk about the way the categories are now, the way illnesses are defined now. Give us some background on this. You were a resident when one of the big editions of the DSM came out. What was the reason to create these categories in the first case, and what was the primary concern back then?
Well, you know, it's important to remember that the DSM is really a book of ideas, and it's not yet, none of the categories have been validated by evidence-based research. And as Dr. Regier mentioned, it's becoming more and more apparent that the most fundamental organizing concept of the DSM, that the psychiatric disorders can and should be separated into non-overlapping categories, is proving to be a flaw. And many of us believe this is why progress has been slow and so frustrating in the field.
So the diagnostic criteria, the way they are now, were never supposed to be set in stone.
Exactly. When I was a resident at Columbia, it was during the time that the DSM-3, the forerunner of the DSM-4, was being embarked upon, and Dr. Spitzer, who was one of the architects of the DSM-3, used to present the residents every 3 months a little booklet looking very much like Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, which we were supposed to memorize and know the differences between each of the different manifestations of the DSM-3, or the forerunner of it. And if ever we saw in the emergency room or in the outpatient clinic a patient that didn't meet one of those sets of criteria, we were asked to call Dr. Spitzer, and most often he'd come down if he had a chance and he'd interview the patient with us. And there'd often be a Talmudic discussion about whether the patient met the criteria or didn't meet the criteria. And we got a pretty good education as residents in realizing that much of what occurred back then was basically consensus, and it was not really based on reliable evidence. And the reason for that was that back in the late 70s, establishing reliability between psychiatric diagnoses was really the number one priority of the American Psychiatric Association. At that time, the forerunner of the DSM-3 was such a diagnostic hodgepodge that three different psychiatrists in different parts of the country would give the same case three different diagnoses. So it was incredibly hard to move forward without the field developing a common language that everyone could recognize and speak. And so this was really the fundamental purpose of developing this new nomenclature.
And Alyssa, let me turn to you. Your family has been directly affected by juvenile bipolar disorder, and it is often misdiagnosed. How come that happens, and how are children misdiagnosed? What kind of label do they get?
Well, it's a really difficult problem when your child does have this illness. So many families know that there's something wrong with their child. The presence of bipolar disorder in children was not even acknowledged until 1995. So it's not what's typically thought of by doctors who've been trained under the DSM. And for those who do at this point acknowledge that children can be affected by a bipolar disorder, there's no real clear guidance in the DSM as to what it should look like. So the much more typically recognized illnesses such as ADHD, OCD, ODD, these are what are typically grabbed at first. In the absence of providing a diagnosis that really speaks to the condition, everything else is diagnosed first. And sometimes the treatments hit, and most often they don't, and very frequently they exacerbate the situation. So it's years. It's typically 10 years before a child will receive a correct diagnosis that what they're suffering with is a bipolar disorder.
And what are some of the behaviors that may be similar between ADHD and bipolar that may lead somebody to look at their DSM and say, oh, here's what you have?
Well, there's a lot of aggression, a lot of just out-of-control frustration. You often hear of rage. There's difficulty concentrating, difficulty with sleep. So all of these things speak to depression. They speak to ADHD. The kid who can't sit in his seat, the kid who is having a tantrum on the floor, in addition to the fact that these things look like other more common diagnoses, they also just look like a kid testing the limits to see what is and is not allowed in their home. But it's quite clear that it is not that. Anybody who's raised multiple children can instantly see a difference between difficult, really stretching the limit behavior and what these children go through. And as far as the other diagnoses go, you know, we're sort of at the mercy of the field telling us what's wrong with our children. It doesn't get better, and it's very frustrating. At this point, I feel very fortunate that I'm aware of the research that Dr. Poplos and his colleagues have done. And to me, what they are describing as pediatric bipolar disorder resonates in my soul as going in the right direction. But nothing else comes close to the full presentation of what these children do.
And Dr. Poplos, how is juvenile bipolar disorder currently defined in the DSM? And what is the status quo in treating these young children?
Well, actually, there really is no diagnosis for pediatric bipolar disorder in the DSM as it stands now. And from what we understand about the draft proposals, there is no plan to include a diagnosis for pediatric bipolar disorder, despite the fact that it presents very differently in children than it does in adults. And that's something we've known for the last 8 or 9 years, because there have been a number of studies that have looked at the differences and demonstrated them.
And talk a bit about how it expresses itself in children as compared to adults.
You know, in many ways that depends on your point of view, but typically it presents with very rapid cycles of mood, not the really distinguishable as periodic with long periods of duration of mania or depression, which is one of the major distinguishing features between pediatric bipolar disorder and adult bipolar disorder. As they're defined in the DSM, new definitions are emerging based on dimensional classifications, which Dr. Regier mentioned, that are being gradually imported into the K-12 categorical definitions that are still part of the DSM.
Now, I want to go back to the issue of using behavior as a way to diagnose mental illness. Alyssa has highlighted how that can lead to a misdiagnosis. What are some of the red flags in your mind that this is not a good way to go?
Well,
or not the only way to go.
You know, behaviors are really vague and hard to identify objectively, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is really much more fundamental than that. It's again, it's important to remember that the DSM is just a book of ideas. The categories haven't been validated. And one of the major problems, which has been mentioned a number of times, about the fact that these conditions frequently, when you diagnose according to DSM, you have a potpourri of different diagnoses. And this gets back to the original problem where reliability was the main concern, and so experts were essentially forced into putting different symptoms into different baskets without really any evidence that there was separation between the different categories.
So what should we be doing instead, or how should we address these issues instead to get a clearer picture?
Well, the perspective that we started with about 8 years ago was basically not to use a categorical approach. We basically took symptoms from all of the major childhood psychiatric disorders that were comorbid or co-occurring with bipolar disorder, and we gathered very large profiles and very large samples, over 6,000 cases around the country, and we looked at all of these symptoms together rather than dividing them up into preordained categories, and out of that emerged a very clear picture that is quite different in terms of what bipolar disorder looks like in adults. This picture turns out to be actually a group of symptoms that define a condition that points us very directly to some of the neurocircuitry that Dr. Regier was mentioning, particularly the fear circuitry in the brain. In fact, the condition that I'm describing we've called fear of harm because it incorporates many symptoms of fearfulness. I think using this dimensional approach has brought us much closer than we ever would have been if the starting point had been using the current diagnostic nomenclature. Now, set of symptoms, this specific syndrome that we see as a subtype of pediatric bipolar disorder is the most severe subtype, since most of these kids present with very severe symptoms of mania and depression, and also are the ones that have the highest rates of hospitalization, the highest rates of psychosis and suicide. So we feel that what has been uncovered using this approach is the form first of this illness in children, at least its most severe form. And we've been able to do that in a very different way that helps us see why using the categorical diagnoses, we have children being diagnosed with three or four different conditions, because this coherent picture essentially draws specific symptoms from different categories.
Okay, we have to take a break in a second, but let me ask you, Alyssa, can you describe this fear of harm profile that Dr. Popolos just started to mention?
Well, it's a very complicated profile, and the reason why it is so complicated is because it really does incorporate an enormous amount of symptoms and behaviors that the previous understanding of bipolar disorder did not. So I think what's important for the audience to understand is that this dimensional approach has clustered together symptoms into dimensions of behavior. Now, some of those dimensions speak to mania and depression. Others of them speak to what we call, one is called territorial aggression, another one is called fear of harm, and another one has a very unusual title of PPSO, which incorporates carbohydrate craving and psychosis and obsessions. So there's a whole variety of things, but each of these dimensions has told us something different about the profile. And in fact, it was the PPSO one, which was one of the dimensions that most directly led to understanding the underlying pathophysiology of the behavior. So had we stuck with just a focus on what is the more and more refined way to consider how mania affects this illness, we would never have clustered together these symptoms and been able to look in front of us at a complete profile of these children. So each of these dimensions has contributed to our understanding. These kids are, you know, we're finding things about them that every parent would see but would never think of mentioning to their doctor. These kids sweat profusely. They kick off their covers at night. They have thermal regulation issues. And Dr. Pavlos can speak to how complicated this is, but it all goes down to a neurocircuitry that just reaches out to all the very primitive survival functions in our body, sleep onset, sleep offset. And the picture is extraordinary. Very complex, very pervasive. It affects every aspect of their mood and their daily experience, but it's amazingly logical and elegant the way that nature would have a system go through your body.
So if we pick kids based on the DSM categories to study them, we don't arrive at those kinds of findings, is basically what you're saying.
Well, you know, my concern, the new proposed TDD diagnosis, which has been created to separate out children who experience chronic irritability as opposed to episodic mania, is concerning to me. I am absolutely sure that there is a difference, a meaningful difference, between these two experiences. But I'm afraid that keeping a narrow categorical focus on mania as the defining feature of a diagnosis will prevent us from seeing the whole picture as this dimensional approach has done, and therefore will obscure really important aspects of this that lead to all sorts of new treatment ideas.
All right, we have to take a short break. We're talking still about the DSM and one diagnosis specifically, and that's juvenile bipolar disorder. And we're talking with Alyssa Bronstein. She is the director of the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation, and Dr. Dimitri Papalos. He's the author of The Bipolar Child. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Mike and Scott in for Dan Gottlieb today, and this is Voices in the Family.
The Patriots Theater at the Trenton War Memorial supports WHYY, presenting Jesus Christ Superstar, with lyrics by Tim Rice and music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Set in two acts, Jesus Christ Superstar tells the story of the final 7 days in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, featuring such notable songs as Superstar, Everything's All Right, and more. At the Patriots Theater at the War Memorial, Tuesday, March 9th at 7:30 p.m. 609-984-8400 or warmemorial.com.
Homoshow acceptance of gays and lesbians is on the rise, so coming out of the closet isn't such a big deal anymore, is it? In Hollywood, evidently it is.
I just worked with Meredith Baxter, who I took out of the closet, and that was quite a shocker.
We meet with a consultant who specializes in helping stars come out. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott in for Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the DSM, the proposed changes, and we're talking about juvenile bipolar disorder. Our guests are Alyssa Bronstein and Dr. Dimitri Papalos. Bronstein is director of the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation, and Dr. Papalos is also associated with this foundation, and he's the author of The Bipolar Child. Now, we were just talking about, you know, diagnosing these kids and taking a closer look at how the disorder manifests itself. And you were talking, Alyssa, about something called TDD. What does that stand for? And that's something proposed in the new DSM.
Yes, it is a proposed diagnosis. The TDD stands for Temper Dysregulation Disorder with Dysphoria. And my understanding, I'm not involved in the research, but my understanding is, you know, that many people have been concerned about two important issues. One, there's been a very rapid increase in the number of children who have received a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which leads to the prescription of very heavy-duty drugs. And two, is that these kids who are experiencing bipolar disorder look really different from the adults who have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. They're frequently marked with a chronic irritability as opposed to clearly defined episodes of mania. And so the question really has become, you know, if episodic mania is the defining feature of a bipolar diagnosis, can we consider these kids still bipolar, or are they something else? So I won't comment on the research that has led to this phenotype. We believe that they have cleaved off a fragment of really a whole disorder that's desperately trying to be seen as a whole. We have no doubt that some children are being misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder and clearly do fit the TDD TDD profile better than a bipolar disorder diagnosis. We do not like the bipolar disorder diagnosis either. What is written in DSM is not what we would write if we could. But nevertheless, we're very concerned because we don't think that this categorical definition, which uses the categorical definition of mania as a jumping off point, is going to lead to the type of meaningful biologically based answers that any of the other categories in the DSM are going to lead to.
Dr. Papalos, can you describe, in your opinion, what should we be looking for at this point in time? Should we look at specific parts of the brain that might be influencing this kind of profile? What is it that we should be searching for?
Well, the various dimensions of the fear of harm subgroup that we've identified has pointed us very directly to an ancient neural circuit in the brain that regulates essentially behaviors that are related to survival. And I think we know that, for example, bipolar disorder is commonly associated with appetite disorders, sleep disorders, anxiety disorders, particularly obsessive-compulsive disorder. And this circuitry clearly, anxiety or fearfulness, this circuit clearly is responsible for the regulation of most, if not all, of those behaviors. So in some ways, it's kind of the mother lode. And looking at that circuitry and the relationship within the various parts of the brain that that it connects, I think is going to tell us an enormous amount about a whole group of disorders that we've long seen as related, but using the DSM-4 criteria, we've separated off into different baskets, into different categories that essentially, in our view, have prevented us from really moving ahead to understand the biological basis of these behaviors.
So if we were to identify, okay, this is exactly what's wrong in the brain causing X, Y, and Z, what could we do next then?
Well, for example, one of the we believe we've identified a physiological marker for this particular fear of harm profile that has to do with some problem with body temperature regulation that affects the sleep cycle, that affects many aspects of the condition. One of the things that these children do typically is they overheat at night, and when they overheat, they wake up out of REM sleep and experiencing very vivid dreams about that are horrific about survival and pursuit. And one of the things we realized is if we could lower their body temperature during the night, we could potentially correct particularly the sleep problems, and maybe we thought more. We've looked at over 200 children now, and about 90% of them have responded to what would be considered non-pharmaceutical treatments, basically melatonin, which is a commonly used hypnotic. It's essentially a hormone, a pineal peptide, that lowers body temperature and promotes sleep for that reason. And the other thing we've introduced are fans that ventilate the body during the night. And both of these methods have had enormous effect for most, if not, I would say, a large majority of the children that have this phenotype. So based on clinical symptomatology that we observed, and what we thought and think is a physiological marker, we've been able to deduce a specific treatment that treats at least part of the disorder. It doesn't treat all of the symptoms.
And let me get Alyssa to respond on that. She had a comment.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that a large issue that is driving this conversation in the public is the medications that we use for these children. They're very powerful drugs. Everybody's concerned about what the down-the-road effect is of these drugs. And we don't use these drugs on our children lightly. It's a horrible experience. So what we're all desperate for is our treatments that will actually fix these kids, make them have their lives back. And so when you actually know what the targets are that are involved in the illness, my goodness, then you can come up with the right treatments. In addition to the melatonin and the, you know, the efforts to lower body temperature, which right now we do in a very, gross way with fans and such. Hopefully that will become more refined in time. There's also blue light therapy. Circadian rhythm is very involved in this. So there are all sorts of things that you can do that actually will end up helping these kids and not just putting them into a coma-like affect.
And unfortunately, we only have about a minute left. Talk briefly, I don't know which one of you wants to take this, but talk briefly about your efforts to have some of this approach included in the DSM and where that's headed.
Why don't I take that as the speaker of the organization? We are trying very hard to get this research acknowledged. It has taken an outside approach for the past 10 years. It's been very hard to get a seat at the table, but we are very delighted to find at this time that we are really embraced by the research approach over at NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health. We could not be more in line with their thinking, and we are trying to bring this research to the proper recognition over at DSM. It will be challenging to bring this kind of a diagnosis into a categorical nomenclature, but we're certainly trying.
All right, and with that, unfortunately, we have to close. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today. Our guests have been Dr. Dimitri Papalos. He's the author of The Bipolar Child, and Alyssa Bronstein, who runs the Bipolar Research Foundation. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll talk about new research on grief. If you have a question, show idea, or comment, please email us at voicesin@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Gita Simons and Stephanie Marudas produced the show. I'm Mike and Scott, behavioral health reporter for WHYY. Dan Gottlieb will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
It's 12:15.